I'm Elijah Soss, and I've been working in tech for nearly 25 years. I've worked with robotics, e-commerce, mobile apps, and social products. I'm now obsessed with how quickly it is shaping our world, and I want it to be for the better. This podcast is about the way tech can have a positive impact on our planet, health, businesses, relationships, and even the little things in our everyday lives. This is the Good User Experience. Hello and welcome. Today I chat with Dr. Kate Cordell and Ken Connect from the mental healthcare startup Opeka. Opeka is led by Dr. Kate Cordell, a principal investigator, health services data scientist, and researcher. Dr. Cordell is a nationwide thought leader for behavioral health technology and integrating data systems to support a whole person approach to care. She's built models for federal, state, and county healthcare providers and community-based agencies to convert behavioral health and social program data into actual decisions, and those decisions into positive outcomes. Dr. Cordell works to identify whether individuals and families are improving during care. She's especially interested in what works, but specifically for whom, since every person and family have a different story, which is often a complex one, but at the same time interwoven with many common threads. Dr. Cordell uses longitudinal analysis methods to model the changing patterns in these complex tapestries, hoping to identify common elements of design. Since I hate to break with tradition, I'm all over the place as we dive into their product, backgrounds, and speculation as to where the future of mental health care and general health care might take us next. Please enjoy this chat with Dr. Kate Cordell and Ken Connect. Welcome, Ken and Kate.
Thanks, Eli. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Of course. Where do we find you guys today?
We are in Folsom, California.
Beautiful Folsom, California, near the state capital.
Yes, absolutely.
And is that where the company is headquartered as well, correct?
It is. Yes, it is.
Awesome. Awesome. So listen, I'm going to jump right into it. You guys just raised your seed round for this product that you built in the mental health care space. And I've done a bunch of digging through your website because I think it was, 5 years ago? Let me back up a little bit. Ken, I've known you forever. I've known you for, 11, 12 years now?
I think maybe longer than that, Eli. I mean, it's been a while.
It's crazy. When I first met you, you were like the only person that I knew who knew about SEO, and you taught me about SEO. I remember reading all of the little documents you send over, and I'd commit them to memory so I could go out and tell people about SEO and hopefully not sound like too big of an idiot. I counted on you to make me sound smart. And yeah, that was a long, long time ago. And then you went on to do other marketing services, including reputation management and other digital marketing programs. And then, Kate, I met you about 5 years ago. Is that about right? Something like that. I think that's how long you've been working on this particular iteration of the product.
4 years ago, maybe. Four or five.
Yeah. 4 years ago, maybe. It's all a blur, isn't it? Especially when you have kids. Everything just kind of blends together.
Yeah, 17. Yeah. 17. So that make it 4 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. And when I saw it, I think I was looking at some mid-fidelity wireframes that had a little bit of color in them and some pitch decks and presentations. And we're trying to make sense as to how the whole back end would work and be architected and what kind of language and platform it would be best suited for. So this has come a long, long way from ideas and pitch decks into a full-blown deployed product that now has a substantial seed fund behind it. So I'm going to let either of you kind of tell the audience in your own words what this product does and why it's going to change everything in this game of mental health care.
So what this product does, it does four things. Maybe we bit off quite a bit. It does four things. First of all, it conceptualizes a human as a whole person. So when you get mental health care, you're often conceptualized as a physical person or as a spiritual person or as a productive job employee or these various things. And mental health is split, depending on who you see for your mental health, into these various categories. And very rarely does somebody look holistically at a whole person to provide well-being care. And that's what this product does. So it unifies a person back to be their whole self, where we consider all aspects of the person, including their emotional, physical, spiritual, productivity, safety, hygiene, activities of daily living, all of the different parts of a person are now unified back together. And that's what makes up your well-being. And so by doing that, what we do is we unify care across all the different agencies that may provide you care, whether that be you're getting a prescription from your doctor for your well-being in some way, shape, or form, or you're doing mindfulness at home, or your exercise regimen, or whatever it is that you're doing for your well-being. We unify that all back together. And what we do is we use AI to identify what's working for you. So it's very person-centered, and that's why the name of the application is called Person-Centered Intelligence Solution. What it does is it identifies what activities and interventions that you're doing are actually improving your well-being.
That is so cool. I've got like an endless amount of questions. I don't even know where to start. You know where I want to start is I want to start with your background, Kate, because it sounds like you came from a place where you identified this problem probably in a line of work or research that you've done, unlike Ken, who probably identified problems with how to put the product together. I'd love to hear about the real world use cases, who the specific users, people who would license the product or subscribe to the product are, and how you identified that.
Yeah, sure. So we really are, I'd like to say we're not trying to boil the ocean. We're trying to help people catch a fish at a time. But my background is that I began actually doing mental illness research at the lab bench as a cell and molecular biologist, and looked into and had a medical model lens of mental illness. So I actually started out with a pestle and a mortar with schizophrenic brains, honestly, and did PCR and looked at the DNA. Went from that, but realized, to really loving the data aspect of it. So we were screening, I set up a robotics laboratory to screen 1 million points a week of potential drugs for various neurological disorders or mental illness. Ended up with a dementia drug out of that work, but fell in love with the data and the AI back in the 90s. So was an early AI adopter, got my master's in statistics because of that love, and actually worked for a company doing in silico drug discovery for various illnesses, but felt that I wasn't able to make the impact that I wanted. So I actually moved to in vivo studies for mental illnesses, where at that point I was able to use the AI statistics degree that I had to look at things like ALS, neurological mice walking on treadmills, and using the AI to identify the gait of the mice to see if they were, you know, as the disease progressed, if that changed and how it changed in relation to drugs that they were being prescribed. However, having started out my career with this medical model lens of mental illness and neurological disorders, I felt like there was a very large social component that was missing from that view. And actually went into public health and got my PhD from UC Berkeley in social welfare, because there was such a social component that we were missing with that medical model lens. And through that research, really identified that well-being goes beyond a prescription, way beyond a prescription. And in fact, prescriptions don't work that well for many, many people. They may work for some, but for many, many people, there isn't a prescription out there that's going to address their well-being or their mental illness. So what else can we do? What kind of interventions can we do? And sometimes the interventions are cost-free. Sometimes it's a sleep intervention. Sometimes it's a hydration intervention. Sometimes it's mindfulness. And so how can we combine all of the different activities and interventions a person could do to figure out what specifically is the right combination for a person who's struggling with well-being?
So these interventions, this is all new to me. I don't know, maybe it was on the roadmap and I just didn't hear about it when we spoke a few years ago. Because a few years ago, it sounded like the product was more focused on the disconnect between the professional providers for these different patients or clients in regards to being able to share progress as to what's working, what isn't, whether that is some sort of a medication or just talk therapy or whatever it may be. And all of these other attributes that you're speaking of now, I mean, it sounds amazing and it all makes complete sense. Like, of course it should be like that. Of course, maybe you should stop eating Cheetos and binging on Netflix before you reach for a RSSI or, you know, anything else. But are you, by you or the AI, I mean the platform, making any sort of these informed recommendations to the patients on the platform? Or is it really just to keep track of things that they might be trying?
No, the AI does identify what their patterns are in between their activities and their up and their downturns of well-being, and then can make recommendations. The difference between, say, a doctor giving you a recommendation, which is always going to be the same for everybody that comes in the door, you need to lose weight, exercise more, you know, have a healthier diet, right? And everybody gets the same recommendation, no matter who they are. What we can do now with personalized AI is look at people who look like you and what it is they'd be more apt to actually adhere to. So instead of telling you to exercise more, it can be more specific and say, take the stairs. And if that's something that someone who looks like you would do, that's a recommendation it could make. And so it's not going to be the grand recommendation that, of course, everybody should do, but those little baby steps that we know that people like you would do. And then it builds on that.
Very interesting. So in regards to those different recommendations, yeah, going back to more of this inception of the product where there was just this disconnected lineage of record keeping and sharing across different practitioners, it now sounds that this is more focused on the actual patient or the client or that user who's getting the recommendations, as opposed to the clinician or other healthcare provider. So who is the one that actually is the subscriber to this? Is this publicly available or only available through specific healthcare networks? How does that work?
Yeah, so we started off with the clinician because actually in today's day and age, clinicians are bombarded with potential information about the patient or the client in care. And it's difficult for them to understand all of the information about their anxiety, their depression, their prior medication, their trauma history, all of the information, their PTSD symptoms, whatever it is that they have. It's very difficult for clinicians to put that together into a whole story. So the very first thing that we do is for, as a clinician tool, to begin building a person's story so that they can say, hey, I've served somebody who has a similar story to this person before, and I really saw that motivational interviewing or EMDR, eye movement desensitization worked really well for this other person, and they had a similar story, so that may work well for this person. As we begin to build the story and the AI learns about it, the recommendations can go to the clinicians for things that need to be prescribed or clinically monitored, right? But you extend that further to our patient portal or a client portal, and the idea is to really, in the long run, provide that self-sufficiency for the person themselves because they cannot be in care forever. They must learn to maintain their own well-being, and they must learn to understand what their triggers are for the affect that they have or the dysregulation and the emotions that they may have on a day-to-day basis or the urges to use drugs or the urges for maltreatment or abuse in their home. If they can begin to understand what these triggers are and what leads up to that, then they can intervene. And when I say intervention, it ranges from a broad perspective, from prescription drug interventions to, for a foster kid, the intervention may be the family they're placed with. That is in itself an intervention. Drinking water, more water in a day is an intervention.
Getting more than 3 hours of sleep a night, little things, yeah.
More than three, yeah, exactly. That can be an intervention covers anything, any activity you're doing, whether that be a prescribed intervention or just simply an activity of your day. So initially, our first product, Person-Centered Intelligence Solution, is the tool to help clinicians better understand their populations. But the patient portal that we're building onto that will be available to patients to better understand their own progress in care and their own well-being, upturns and downturns. And then disconnecting that from the care portal, they can continue to use that app as a self-sufficiency monitor beyond care.
Okay, so I'm going to put on my patient hat first. and I'm going to say, wow, this sounds great. I want AI to make some informed decisions about me, and have gone through times where I'm just completely ridden with anxiety. And the thought of finding a therapist that is going to work is hard enough. But then if I do find somebody, the rehashing of the stories and what's been effective and, oh, and there's this childhood trauma and just trying to get all that out again, I would love for there to be some sort of centralized record that could be simply passed over that went a little bit deeper than the confidential scribblings of the therapist. So you're saying that in the near future, there will be this kind of consumer product version like this actually publicly available. I can, as just somebody who doesn't want to rely on different healthcare networks that I might be placed into, on them using the platform, I could use it myself and then basically take that to the service provider and say, hey, here's my OPECA record, check it out. But that's not here yet, but that's something that's coming?
Correct. That's not here yet. We have the clinician portal, the patient portal we're hoping to have out this year, and that is exactly what we hope to do. It'll disconnect from your care provider and allow you to carry it around in your pocket, and you can share it with a new care provider. And it doesn't only just give them your story, it gives them a story map. So even if they don't have time to read your whole story, they can look at a visual depiction of what your life trajectory was.
Like a little infographic. Oh, and there's the part where your parents ruined your life.
Right.
Exactly.
He builds the infographics for that.
Yeah. I'm sure Ken does. Okay. So I love this idea as well of, I remember pick an affliction like insomnia, and then you go and talk to the therapist about insomnia, talk to the doctor about insomnia. They, of course, have different recommendations. One is more focused on the anxiety. The first thing the doctor says, well, are you exercising? I'm like, man, I'm exercising like 7 days a week, 2 hours a day. I'm so tired of answering like these baseline questions of, you know, I have a laundry list in journals of things that I have tried. I love the idea of this being all packed up. And then at the same time, I'm a little freaked out about putting this personal information into the hands of somebody else. Even if I try to do a bit of journaling every morning, and I love the fact that it's on my desktop and my iPhone and my laptop, and also sitting in the cloud waiting to get hacked with all my, you know, deepest, darkest personal thoughts on there. So who owns the data, and how is that managed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we don't own the data. The data is owned. If it's under care, the care provider owns the data and they release it to you. Now, when they release it to you, then of course you can continue to have your data in our system, and then you own the data. We do not own the data. It is health data, and so it is your data.
So I know that it was probably a whole series of massive headaches dealing with HIPAA compliance and how this all works. So I'm wondering, when it goes from one healthcare provider to another healthcare provider, both of whom may not be on the system at the same time at any given point, but would greatly benefit from having all of this patient information over to them, how does that work in regards to the rights of privacy? And is it the patient that needs to then sign over the rights to move this over and then have another service provider onboarded onto your platform? How does that work?
Yeah, so it's the same as any other healthcare provider. You would need to have a sign off that you would share it between one provider and another, but it takes out the middleman. You become the middleman, right? Instead of them talking to each other, they talk through you. And so if you wanted to share your information with another provider and they were also using our system, then it's simply a push of a button. Now, if they're not using our system, then it's a matter of exporting those records and sharing them to them as electronic files or paper files the old-fashioned way.
So what is the current business model? Who do you go to first with this product?
So first, we're going to community-based providers and state government providers that are serving folks who are multi-system involved. So we're talking foster youth are being served by both, you know, child welfare as well as mental health quite often. They may also be served by probation, school mental health. And so there's this multi-system involvement where right now, those children need to navigate that system themselves. And they need to be the intermediary communicator between the foster family, the child mental health professional at school, social worker that talks to them, or their group therapy. That's a lot to put on a child who's already experienced trauma and removal from the home. And so foster care agencies are one of the top agencies of interest for our product, because we really begin to unify that information for the foster youth. The other thing about foster youth is they often don't have their records, their own records, and they don't know any of their medical history or any of their history at all, really, because a lot of times they were too young to remember. So this allows them to bring forward their own information, their own record, so that they have that history of how much anxiety they were feeling at 6 versus how much they're feeling at 8 or 10 or 12. And so they're able to see their own journey and track that and share that. So they don't have to tell and retell their story. It's in their own portal. Foster youth are a big market for us, as well as children's mental health, because they often have children who are involved in mental health care, often have a number of complex issues. And again, you're going to have the schools involved. You're going to have the parents. You're going to have usually the primary care physician is going to be involved in that case. And so this is going to help unify all that information. Other multi-system involved families, like folks who are criminally justice involved. We are eventually getting down to single system involvement, but we're starting out with the multi-system involvement because it has the most need for reunifying the person into a whole person.
I'm a little bit ignorant in some of the terminology. So when you say multi-system, are those a bunch of these different entities that are all wrapped up under one bureaucratic tangle of an umbrella, but under the same funding source and able to share the same system and be on the same platform, even though one might be in foster care, one might be in law enforcement, they'd all ideally be under the same branch and using the same system?
Well, currently they all use different systems, and that'll continue. They, you know, because they have their own laws and regulations they need to follow. A criminal court case is going to have a different set of data points than a foster case, than a mental health case.
So how does the data get in from a court case versus it was licensed to a foster care provider or therapist? How do those different data points get in there? How does the story get fleshed out and become complete throughout the journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're thinking about information in a different way than has been historically done. We call it person-centered because that's what we do. We centralize the data around the person in the form of questions and answers. The question can be any kind of question, like how much anxiety did you feel today? Did you meet with your probation officer today? What kind of prescription medication are you taking today? You know, so the questions are all about that person and the answers relate to that question. And because we conceptualize data in that way, it's the easy button. We don't need to worry about what data model people are on or how often they collect this, that, or the other. We convert that all into a person-centered map where every point connects back to that person in care. That's the way we conceive it. And then we integrate, we calibrate those questions in our system around a person, and then we integrate through API or file transfer with the electronic systems as they exist. And as long as that person exists in that system, then they will exist in our system, and we'll pull those questions and answers in around that person.
So say I'm in foster care and I put in my entry that, yeah, I'm feeling pretty bad today, and the API pulls in that I just got arrested for something. And you're basically making that match on the back end, even though that was just an API call. That wasn't actually something that was input from the criminal department because they were on the platform. Like, and so do you have these different APIs established into some, and are these going to be different for every city, county, state, on and on and on? Does that get pretty complex?
It can be complex, but nowadays most systems have APIs, although we integrate with some that do not. We do file transfer as well. There's also health information exchange, which has simplified data. So, you know, because we create that question and answer, there's a resource on HL7 FHIR that we can use for health information exchange. So nowadays, that is not as difficult as it was, say, 10 years ago. There are still some older systems that, you know, obviously need to do a file transfer. But again, it's not that difficult when it comes down to it these days, I wouldn't say. I mean, right. All of our integrations have been pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
The hardest thing is sometimes just getting time from somebody who oversees the system to be like, yeah, okay, sure.
We also want to eliminate dual entry. I know it's a big barrier for a lot of people. Oh, another system we got to enter data into. We don't want that. We want to connect to what's already being, a system that's already getting the data input. So.
Right. We're a Microsoft partner company. Like, for example, if you're using a Microsoft Dynamics system for whatever you're managing, whatever data you're managing, we have single sign-on and launch. So they don't even know they're using our system.
Oh, okay. Okay, interesting. And it sounds like the patient or client or whoever it might be who is giving all of this regular feedback that is really centered around just sentiment, like how am I doing? And then these other data points, AI is basically building a bigger picture as to, okay, what's being effective, what isn't, what's causing more harm than good, and on and on. Sounds like a very kind of personal, portable experience. Are you building a native mobile app that is probably going to be more focused around the patient?
Yeah, that's correct. Our native mobile app will be focused around the patient. It's called OptiRhythms because it looks for the optimal rhythms of your day. Again, it will be able to be standalone. You don't have to be in care to use it, although it will work for you if you are in care under guidance of a clinician or a doctor. But yeah, so there will be a standalone and a companion app for the person-centered intelligence.
This is huge, huge, huge in terms of the number of people who are having these issues. It sounds like you are starting with the most critical and underserved cases in the center of this just kind of like horrible Venn diagram of mismanagement and then kind of working your way out to the edges. I'd seen read on your website, it was one in every five individuals experience a mental health disorder every year. I mean, you're standing in a room with five people and somebody's just, you know, experiencing a mental health disorder.
I think that number has actually grown, Eli, since, yeah, you know, since the pandemic started.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've got lots of pandemic questions for you, but
you know, people are talking about mental health a lot more. So, you know, and the pandemic really kind of pushed this whole thing into, you know, everybody's involved now. Everybody's got some kind of mental health issue. Most people are dealing with that.
One in three.
Wow. So that is a considerable gain right there.
Yeah, so we got three.
Yeah. Here. I was going to ask about COVID in regards to, I know that there was a lot of regulation that was eased up just a bit during the pandemic for a lot of reasons like, oh yeah, I know I've got an ear infection. I don't want to go into a healthcare facility and risk getting infected and they're already overburdened and I can't see anybody for 3 weeks. So they're like, yeah, telehealth, why don't you guys just go ahead and do it? HIPAA will ease up a little bit, but you know, we're still going to, you know, make sure privacy stays intact. So during your development roadmap and with COVID happening and this mental health care crisis really spiraling out of control during that time, were you able to make some jumps in progress that wouldn't have been possible like in different time durations because of that?
You know, I think Kate and I have been working this so long, we've seen that we've seen mental health as an issue way before the pandemic. We were like, wow, this is a really major problem. I think the pandemic just kind of, it did accelerate things. It got a lot of more people interested in what we were doing. So I'd say it definitely accelerated what we were doing over, you know,
I meant with regulation, Ken, because I mean, I know that there are a lot of people working on telehealth or just trying to do something to sort through this massive clusterfuck of healthcare in our country and, you know, how many people can't afford it or can't get help or are, you know, and dying as a result. It's in a bad, bad state. So I know that there were a lot of smaller organizations that were able to do things in this last year that they ordinarily couldn't have because of all of the bureaucracy and red tape and regulation. And I wondered if there were things, because this does sound very complex in regards to privacy and sharing records and having the continuity of that story and keeping it all intact with privacy and just all of the other things you have to consider. The roadmap that you guys had, I mean, was it already kind of set and nothing really changed except for the accelerated need for this? Or were there some things that you were able to move faster on the technology side because of COVID and regulation?
It didn't help us out in any way in terms of moving faster. It did help us with fundraising. We were looking at fundraising right before the pandemic, and we were pitching over in the Bay Area. Folks did not want to touch mental health with a 10-foot pole in terms of investment back then. And the questions we were asked, they were just so uninformed about mental health. The questions were just off the wall. Yeah. You had to try to be polite to answer them.
I got a lot of blank stares.
And so now everybody's so much more informed. I think the fundraising is the one area that really did help us. In terms of regulations, no, it slowed things down really, because nobody wanted to make a decision about anything during the pandemic, you know, and they were just, everyone was just holding on to the rails, waiting for it to end. Nobody was going to spend a dime on anything new or innovative. Nobody was going to move forward or make any decisions on spending. So now, though, now that we're kind of hopefully coming out of the pandemic, there are some funding sources that are becoming available to address this issue. So I'm hoping in the next year we'll see that. To date, no, we have not seen a positive impact on our business outside of more attention. It hasn't resulted in any reduced regulations that impact us. Although there is more, and I don't think this is because of the pandemic, there is more interest in people owning their own data. I think GDPR over in England has influenced that, as well as, of course, you know, Facebook being in the news and so forth. And so that ability for people to own their own data and their own health data, those regulations have eased up. But I don't think that's due to the pandemic.
It's interesting. I don't think Facebook really saw that one coming. I don't know if you saw the statistics when that latest version of iOS finally came out and people were asked if they wanted to opt in to be tracked around the web. Facebook was like, people don't mind. It's not going to be that big of a deal. 94% of people said, nope, I don't want to be tracked around the web. That's a game changer. But it starts to open your eyes to, when given the choice, how people feel about their privacy and their data. So that's going to change a lot of things in the world of marketing and everything else. But unfortunately, with healthcare and healthcare systems, I feel like it's largely been a detriment in regards to letting the smaller players with great ideas innovate and actually take a run at the market. Because when you look at the landscape of big tech, they're running out of places to go, right? So when you look at the big, juicy, multi-billion dollar sectors, and you're kind of like, okay, I'm done with making cars and shooting things off into space. I'm going to take healthcare, right? Or I'm going to take education. Like, I'm going to bring that down. Complexity and bureaucracy become impediments to innovation. In other words, if you don't have the resources and the legal firepower to get around that stuff, it becomes really difficult to innovate in that space and take these better ideas and bring them to market. So it's super exciting for me to see you guys be able to do this. And I'm sure, like, your background and knowing the space so well helped a ton. And it's unfortunate what everybody went through this last year with COVID and how many people are suffering from mental health as a result of it. And at the same time, like, some omelets are going to come out of all these broken eggs, and hopefully we'll see much better ways to address this through technology in the future here. And I want to geek out on the product for a little bit here. I want to hear more about these story maps. I love good UI. I love nice visuals. I love seeing information at a glance and not having to dig through a bunch of text reports. So tell me a little bit about what goes into these story maps and their kind of visual expression in the product.
Ken, I'll let you take that. Yeah. So everything, if I were to have designed it, it would be an algebraic formula. So
it would look like research paper.
That's Ken's superpower, is he takes my stick figures and my formulas and he turns them into works of art.
Yeah, well, that's why Kate and I work so well together. You know, she's got these brilliant ideas, and a lot of times I'll say, just drop this chicken scratch and let me take it and I'll work with it, right? So you mentioned earlier, Eli, that first time you met with us about this product, we were showing wireframes, and that's kind of what we did. That was our roadshow for the first year or so, was taking around high fidelity or low fidelity in some cases, mock-ups, and showing what the potential product could do. But you know what? It built enough excitement in people to be able to take a next step and start building it out. The story maps, something Kate came up with a few years ago, and it's started talking about the idea about having all these data points going in and being person-centered and building these story maps that at a glance show you, you know, past trauma, strengths and skills you can build, current things you have to work on, and then background needs and things to focus on. So it, at a glance, you can see, okay, I can see exactly where this person, where they've been, what they've gone through, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, what they need to build, and get a good idea for a potential treatment plan.
So in terms of the visual representation of that, are users uploading any sort of imagery that I just have like all these crazy ideas in my head now of like what the AI could be doing in the background and pulling from devices and I mean, on and on and on, right? So is this right now in terms of, you know, if I was the patient using the product, am I just checking off a few radio buttons in a form from a series of questions? Or am I like actually uploading any other sort of rich media? How does that work? Or maybe taking a video?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're headed that way with more of the rich media stuff. But you know, currently we're trying to make assessments, especially done on mobile devices and watches, even just really kind of emoji based, really simple. Even some, you know, thinking about using voice inflection and kind of answering questions with how the tone of your voice even.
So. Yeah.
Amazon has that product, right? Was it a Ring or Fitbit kind of bracelet tracker?
Mm-hmm.
It was actually, do you hear about this? I don't think it really ended up going anywhere because I don't even know it's available anymore. Every time I open up Amazon, they have some other weird kind of Black Mirror product that is either going to be around for weeks or months or just disappear. Right now, it's like glasses that are just like glasses with Alexa in them, which is kind of strange instead of like,
Right.
I don't want to talk into my watch or reach for my phone. I just want to talk into my glasses that aren't doing anything else but providing a speaker. But they had something like, I think it was on a bracelet. It's listening to you all day and then basically giving you a report after running some low-level AI on your happiness scale, right? Like, or when you had this conversation, did you sound aggressive, confrontational, or friendly? Like running this natural language processing on top of the tone of your voice that it learns over time.
Totally.
So, I mean, I imagine that there's a whole slew of products out on the market already that you could be getting biofeedback from. I mean, I wear this like a Whoop tracker 24/7, right? I look at it for the sleep analytics and then primarily a recovery score so that I can have something smarter than my own good judgment say like, you should work out today or hey, maybe you should just rest because you're going to die. There's all these devices throwing off all this telemetry all the time. And I imagine each one of those is a juicy bit of data to wrap up into the AI engine that you guys have for somebody's well-being.
100%. You basically just explained Optorhythms, which is our mobile app that's going to be coming out. But we've been in talks with Apple Health a little bit about running a program where we take all the biometric data that you're currently getting from different apps on your phone and on your watch, pulling in assessment data from our platform and kind of tying that all together and building this whole story from biometric data, assessment data, and all other kinds of data points related to the person.
We also are talking to Signal Action AI, and they do the sentiment analysis of the voice. So we'd like to eventually have you be able to tell your story, and it will identify the anxiety related to different aspects of your story and understand where your triggers are related to your history, your experience. So we'll have, and then we map that onto a visual so that you can see where the different aspects are of your story that are maybe the areas you need to focus on. Was that traumatic experience when you were 4 more important to focus on, or the one when you were 8? And so through telling your story, we'll be able to figure that out. And as Ken mentioned, you know, one of the studies that we're talking about with one of our customers is a study. Again, foster care is a big area of interest for us. And so as foster youth grow up and they have kids of their own, it's difficult for them to manage their own frustration around their children's behaviors because they didn't see it modeled well for them. And so one of the things is you have this intergenerational potential for maltreatment. And so one of the studies we're looking at is using the Apple Watch to help new parents that are former foster youth manage their own frustration levels so that they don't carry on that maltreatment to their own children. So as their heart rate increases, their frustration level increases, the biometric data plus the watch will cue them to say, are you feeling frustrated? They fill that out. And then they have interventions that they get from their clinicians. When their biometrics and their assessment data reach a certain level, their watch will let them know it's time for you to walk around the block or count to 10. And that works with urges, with substance use as well. And so we're looking at a study to do that as well. So we're hoping to have data within the next year to show actually how this type of intervention and this type of AI will help lead to improved well-being.
Well, the Apple Watch, they just keep cramming more and more sensors into it, right? They added versus like, okay, I can look at my heart rate, but if I turn it on, my battery is going to die in a couple hours. But then a pulse oximeter, and I'm not sure now if like the latest one is kind of doing some low-level HRV. I found that the sensors themselves, I think because the device is trying to do so much, yeah, I have all the biometric tools on it, but I'm also, you know, running Instagram on it. How good is it going to be at all of these different things?
Right.
But I think the next release is also going to have blood sugar levels as well. I mean, there's so much data that you could just pull off of that. What I like about the Whoop tracker the most is that it's one of the more reliable HRV sensors that I've found for heart rate variability. And there are a lot of therapists who are now looking at HRV to kind of measure baseline mental well-being, which is super interesting. There's even meditation programs where you can actually sit through a mindfulness practice and watch your HRV in real time with the goal of actually trying to move that number, which is super interesting. How many of, and I know that it's probably like, you're like, wow, there's just so much that we could go after. Is there any one set of data in all of this that you're more focused on than the other, as far as like the next thing to grab, maybe around this area of biometrics?
Our models are elegant in that they're person-centered and they eat up anything you give them, like the DeLorean. So honestly, it will find any association from what you feed it based on you and your patterns of activity, behavior, and response. And so all of this data that you say, you know, you're looking at from your watch and what this does is it takes that all together and finds the associations chronologically over time between what you did today, what you did yesterday, and how you feel tomorrow. So it creates that thread through the data where you're just looking at data in the moment. This is going to identify what did you do and what combination of things that you do that often result in this outcome over and over and over again. And then once it knows that, it can say, hey, people like you, you've never tried it, but people like you also behave and react in similar ways to these other interventions, also do really well with this other intervention. And so it can begin to make recommendations knowing your basically bio footprint.
Yeah. And there's a lot of apps that are out that provide care, or they'll give you a snapshot of data as you're looking at it. But this builds it, like Kate said, it builds a trajectory over time and looks at the story of that data related to you. What is all these, you know, these different apps that are connected? What does it all mean? So it kind of maps out your whole story.
So it'll begin to tell you when you sleep less than 5 hours and 40 minutes, your heart rate's going to be increased for the whole day. When you skip breakfast, you'll have more energy, or you'll work out for 5 minutes longer that evening. Who knows? Maybe somebody different, when they skip breakfast, they'll work out less because their energy, you are okay to skip breakfast. Somebody else may not be. So it's very person-centered, very personalized to your rhythms of your day.
Yeah, there's probably just so much storytelling that could go on that partially is going to come from user input and then also from all of these different calls that you'll be able to make. I noticed that on the Whoop app, I mean, one thing I like about it is that I'm always pressed for time and I need the simplicity of just looking at red, yellow, green, right? Can I go? Do I need to go back to bed or should I just kind of take it easy? And I know that there's a lot of real complex number crunching and different algorithms they're running on my sleep quality, my resting heart rate, my heart rate variability, you know, an actual strain gauge of how hard I've worked that day or that week and what the aggregate looks like. But what I noticed is that when I look at a recovery score in the morning, they're starting to ask a lot more questions. And it used to just be like, did you have caffeine yesterday? Did you have any alcoholic beverages? Right. Now it's like, and then when COVID hit, are you suffering from, have you had a positive COVID test result? And now, did you meditate? Are you in therapy? Like, they're trying to pull in a ton more data points. So I see applications for this AI that you guys are starting to piece together being applicable for not only the greater space of healthcare, but then also athletics and fitness and high performance and everything else. Because while Whoop is focused solely on this aspect of recovery, you know, really more serious athletes and trying to find, you know, the peak time where you can go all out and being able to time that on a calendar, the Apple Watch is more of, you know, I've fallen and I can't get up. And, you know, they have like the SOS and it'll now give you a warning. If you have like some weird heart regularity, you can opt into that. So it seems like more generalized healthcare. I'm wondering where you guys see this going in regards to not just mental healthcare, but healthcare in general. And I'm very interested because, I mean, there's this huge problem with fragmentation in regards to the stories of not just mental health care, but healthcare in general, right? Anybody who has ever switched insurance providers and had to go from Blue Cross to UCLA or UCLA to Kaiser, it's like everything that ever happened to them just evaporates and you're starting over. You know, oh, I sprained my ankle. Okay, let's start with, have you had any surgeries when you were a child? Like, I've filled out these forms. Like, every time I like crash on my bike, I feel like I have to go through more pieces of paper than the closing documents for fundraising, right? It's
all these things going to this black hole. Yeah. You know, we're trying to make that not happen anymore.
It's totally, I mean, I have this dream of just being able to airdrop them like this.
Yes.
This one file that has everything. So, you know, when I think about this and like what's been happening in the space, very, very, very slowly, it's usually just like independent innovators like yourselves that are actually making movement and not these, you know, legacy healthcare providers. I remember a decade ago, EMR was the promise that was supposed to solve all this. And what happened? Now, healthcare providers have websites, and sometimes I can get a report of my visit 2 weeks after I go into the doctor. But yeah, what is your sense as to what happened with EMR in regards to its promise a decade ago and where it is right now? And how do you see that playing into your platform?
Yeah. So, I mean, we integrate with EMRs, EHRs, but they don't have
And I'm sorry, everybody. It's electronic medical records. APIs and application platform interface, programming interface. Like, we're just throwing out acronyms as if everybody is familiar with the space. But like, these medical records that are supposed to be in our phones or on a server instead of in just one person's filing cabinet in that one office. That's the idea.
You know, I remember going to the doctor and they had clipboards. There was no computers. Now everybody's on a laptop. You know, that's the change that has been made.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's on a screen instead of a clipboard now.
They replaced the clipboard.
Exactly.
But they don't have incentive to go outside the four walls of the, you know, institution that they serve. There's no incentive. You know, once you leave and go to another insurer or another provider, there's no incentive for them to follow you, for them, for the medical record themselves, because you don't exist to them anymore. But you do exist, right? And then there's no interoperability, although there are coming out with some health information exchange standards. They're slow to move. And there's not a lot, again, there's not a lot of incentive to share information, because who does it benefit? It benefits the patient. It doesn't benefit the provider, except it may benefit the subsequent provider. But why do I want to do that as the primary provider? I want to make it as difficult as possible for you to leave. Not easy. So I'm not going to spend money to make it easy to transfer your records. So it really has to be somebody coming from outside of all of these individual agencies that's going to unify the information. It's never going to happen within an EMR or electronic medical record or within a single agency. It has to come from the outside.
I remember when HealthKit first showed up on the iPhone and it was kind of empty, right? And it was before I think it came out before the Apple Watch was even out, and it was kind of this harbinger to like, oh, and we're going to have a device that's going to feed into HealthKit. And you could go in and like manually put in your blood pressure and stuff like that. And then, you know, as you'd open it up, there were more and more fields in there, and they started building it out. And I remember when it got to the point where it actually had a somewhat meaningful amount of data that I could manually input or hook up other devices via Bluetooth to and populate. I remember going into a doctor for something and saying like, well, I've been tracking all this stuff and I exported it and printed it out for you. And they just kind of look at it like,
no, they were like that.
I don't care. Fill out these forms. Like they're not going to look at it or read it. Like it's totally, totally not a care in the world. When I think about this conundrum with electronic medical records and medical practices being almost the ultimate centralization of information, right? You know, when you talk about like cryptocurrency and a decentralized finance platform where it's not just like one bank that has your ledger, but it's running on, you know, nobody owns it. It's just on thousands and thousands of different virtual machines that have it. This is literally sitting in like one healthcare provider's structure, you know, in this box that nobody can get to. And if you want to get that data out, it's not likely going to be compatible or something that someone else is likely to look at. And the process of getting it out itself is just horrendous. If anybody has ever had to do that, they know like how hard it is to extract this information. So I'm very, very bullish on all these different decentralized technologies, especially around blockchain. I've been so focused on more of the just kind of like smart contract and finance aspects of blockchain that I haven't really researched or done much thinking about medical applications on it. But when I think about what you're doing and ways to decentralize this information and tell a story across many different providers while keeping privacy in check, it almost sounds like, hey, I've got my private key and this is my public key that you can write to. And then if I want to go and switch providers or involve somebody else in my story, then I share that key with them. Are you guys looking at blockchain technology in your platform?
What you just said is extremely interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of correlations to blockchain and kind of what we're doing. I think that's probably something we'll definitely want to look at in the future. Right now, we're just starting out pretty simple, building these care circles that can share information for an individual to different agencies. So we're at the very beginning of where you took it with some of the blockchain technology.
Yeah, I think that we're waiting for that story to be told with blockchain and healthcare, and then we'll adopt it. But we probably won't be the trailblazer on that until after there's been a little bit more movement.
Yeah, there's just, I get so excited about it. Like when I think about the potential of it, like in any case where you have an issue of centralized information that's hard for the people that need that information to be able to access it, right? And whenever you have an issue around trust, right? Privacy is just another version of issue around trust. Blockchain through cryptography really just kind of squashes both those problems, and having it running on, you know, these thousands of virtual machines also solves the problem of like a, you know, the centralized aspect of it. I can, this idea of the story, you know, of the storytelling and of user input and of high availability just becomes really, really interesting when you kind of think about like how a platform like this could evolve over time.
For sure. Yep. That's really good stuff. And that's exciting. I think it can be, have a lot of direct ties into what we're doing for sure.
Yeah. So when you guys look across the landscape and, you know, you have Apple becoming more and more invested in the space of, I'll just say general wellness, really, they are now doing fitness content. Of course, you know, they have the device and they have HealthKit. And long ago, there was a lot of talk about working on this kind of medical record that would be able to be passed around. And then you have Amazon, which is also taking a run at healthcare. And they're already in everybody's homes every single day or multiple times a day, if it's my home. And it could be as simple as like, hey, I'm not going to say her name because everybody's devices will light up, you know, refill my prescription. And then in 20 minutes, it's at your doorstep. And it makes you wonder where else they're going in this space. I'm sure you guys are watching it pretty closely. Is there any lead horse that you see out there that you feel more bullish on than others? Or how do you feel about innovation in this space right now?
Well, personally, I think that a lot of these players, they're either going to directly to the consumer or they're going to the healthcare provider. The winner's going to be the one that can unify the provider with the consumer. I don't know if that's Apple Health. I would see that Amazon, especially with AWS, has the opportunity to serve both the large healthcare providers as well as potentially the consumers, but it may be a partnership between those. You can't serve just the consumer, although I strongly believe we need to put the self-sufficiency back in the person's hands so that they can understand their own rhythms of their day. And with as much influence and social influence that happens in a day, we need to help them understand and take back the control of their own lives so they know what they're being influenced by so that they can make their own decisions. Who's going to do that best? It's probably, I would hope the winner of that is going to be the person that does it for the good of mankind and not for the dollar in their pocket.
I'd hope so too. The people or the companies with the most heart behind it. I mean, I love your background and just kind of the evolution as to how you came to this for sure. Would love to hear more about the product that is coming out in the fall, I believe, right? Because you have a product on the market right now, and it's the patient portal app, the native mobile app that's going to be coming out in the fall. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And tell me a bit about what that is going to do, if you can. Like, what are some of the features that we'll be seeing in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of what we've been talking about is the patient portal. But the very first thing that it will do is allow folks to have access to their own information that exists on the clinician side. So very slowly, it'll probably start with strengths that folks are trying to build and skills and resiliency factors related to wellness will then roll out more in terms of, you know, maybe their areas of need, whether that be substance abuse, depression or anxiety, and then rolling out to their whole story. So we'll very slowly begin to test the market with rolling out different pieces of information around their story. At the same time, as Ken mentioned, we're working with Apple Health to do formal studies to look at when we integrate the biometric data, what influence does that have on their ability to understand their story? So we'll slowly drip out more and more AI testing along the way to make sure that folks are receptive to that information and that it's helpful and that we're presenting it in the right way so that it can be consumed and make a positive impact in people's lives.
Awesome. And so the product as it is today, that's clinician facing product. And then, Right. Okay. Yep. It's all coming together for me. Sorry. I'm a little slow on the uptake.
It's complex. So we do demos 3 or 4 a day. You know, it takes a while. A lot of times we try and cram a lot into an hour. And just by the end of the hour, the people, like the light bulb goes on. So it's a lot. lot to put your head around.
I've got light bulbs going on all over the place here. I'm lit up like a Christmas tree, Ken. I'm just trying to figure out what's in the can already versus in development versus on the roadmap in your release calendar. The actual patient mobile app is what's going to be dropping in the fall.
Correct.
Yep. Awesome. Awesome. Well, so, you know, as you guys have worked through this and been iterating and really pushing on the idea, have there been any advances in the tools that you're using or technology platforms that have kind of helped move the game as you've been working on this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the AI around sentiment and interpretation of language has really advanced in the last 3 to 4 years. I mean, 3 to 4 years ago, I don't think there was as much out there in terms of AI engines to automatically translate voice to text and then text to sentiment and or voice to sentiment or voice to emotion or affect. And so that piece I find really super intriguing because we want to remove the burden from people being able to communicate their stories and understand their own stories. And so that piece I'm pretty excited about.
Kate mentioned earlier, our friends at Signal Action AI approached us 4 or 5 months ago and said, hey, we're doing this platform that's going to look at tonal analysis, look at your voice, and it's going to kind of rank you on the scale. We were blown away. And they were like, we really love what you guys are doing. Imagine if we could add our tonal analysis to your application. I'm like, yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
So I think there's just a ton of cool things going on in that regard.
Yeah, the whole space is moving so quickly that it becomes a challenge in itself just deciding what you're going to focus on at any given time, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Also, interpretable AI is advancing. So AI is generally, you know, I've been doing AI since 1999, but the AI of the last 5 or 6 years has been a black box. And, you know, it makes a prediction of, is this going to happen or is this not going to happen? Is this picture a cat or is it a dog? But nobody really understands how the neural networks or the AI are making those decisions. We can't have that with what we do. We have to be able to tell you why it is that your anxiety level increased. So having a neural network that just says, hey, your anxiety level is going to increase tomorrow at 5 isn't going to help you understand how to get it not to increase tomorrow at 5.
Right.
Right? So we have to have interpretable models in what we build. And we build all of our own bespoke models. We do not use any off-the-shelf engines.
Oh, interesting.
We build them all from scratch and we make them interpretable. So that is our IP, the ability and the new algorithms out there, the new models that are now available to actually make AI interpretable has been an advancement that we're taking advantage of as well.
That's so cool. It's funny, you know, I can think of a use case as simple as trying to sleep better, right? I found like the older I get or the more stressful that work gets, like the worse I sleep, whether it's falling asleep, staying asleep, having to get up and pee in the middle of the night because I'm getting old, just all those things are, you know, kids waking you up. And part of the reason why the first thing I try to do when I wake up is journal is because I want to get data points in that I never go back and look at because I never have any time to do it. But the idea would be I could go back and try to find these different correlations between, okay, I tried 5 milligrams of melatonin this night and this happened. This is a day I worked out and I slept like this. This is a day that I didn't. This is a day that I had 5 milligrams of edible cannabis. Did that make things better or worse for my sleep and recovery score, you know, and trying to find out because we're all different, right? Like what makes us tick and keep ticking is completely different for every single person. And it's really hard to extrapolate some kind of a data model for what works specifically for you. So I love the idea of robots doing that for me. Like that just, and that's just such a small area, such a tiny use case. Yet if everybody got 20% better sleep or more restful sleep every night, it could literally change the quality of their entire life. Just that one little thing.
Yeah. The other thing I will say that we do that is a little bit different than most AI applications do. Traditionally, for the last 10 years, AI has been predicting who will fail and how bad things happen. That has been the application of AI is where's the fraud? Who's going to cost the most? Who's going to fail? How can I, you know, avoid failure? So we very purposefully focus on success-focused AI. So all of our models focus on how do we better succeed at our goals, not how do we avoid failing. And it's actually a different model than the model that predicts failure. A model that predicts success says, what can you do differently to reach success? A model that predicts failure says, what opportunity is there for you to be a failure based on what you're already doing?
And you'd mentioned these advancements in AI over the course of the project. I love just asking these kind of like startup type questions. And I can imagine after getting funding, you're going to have to start building out a team. But looking back over the last few years, you've had to be incredibly scrappy and have a high level of productivity and output for a smaller team trying to reach this really aggressive, audacious goal of tackling these problems. You mentioned being a Microsoft partner. What are some of the other products or platforms that you feel like have been pretty critical to the actual business part of this venture?
Yeah, so I think Microsoft, obviously, being able to use the cloud, and I'll tell you, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago, even though the cloud was available to get folks to agree to use data that was in the cloud, you know, especially some of the health providing agencies that we work with, wouldn't have happened. I mean, it really is right now this confluence of technology, ownership of data, as well as awareness of mental health, and just folks' abilities to use technology where they wouldn't have 4 or 5 years ago, or trust in technology, I would say, is coming together. So the ability to use the cloud, as standard as that sounds nowadays, is huge. The APIs on, the application programming interfaces that are now available on most other applications allows us to integrate a lot easier. When some of our investors, you know, were integrators since retired years ago, and when we talk about integration, they think it's this huge lift. It's not as big a lift as it was 10 years ago, right? Integration isn't that difficult.
You know, lately we've been kind of describing ourselves as a Zapier for health data.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
So
I like that. That's a really good one. And for people who don't know, Zapier, or, you know, there's some other little scripting engines out there, like If This Then That, are very kind of like low-level basic engines that let you connect different things. Like you have a trigger or an input, and then some sort of routine that you run, and an output like, hey, if it's going to be above 70 degrees today, turn my lights blue in my house. Stuff like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm a big automation fan. I love Zapier. I use it a lot.
Yeah.
I love automating things. So that's a big part of what I do as far as some of the tech that we have.
Yeah. Ken and I have geeked out on automation stuff for a long time. And I think we're going to have a catch up on all our latest tech findings in the world of automation. I've gone to new levels in my house, Ken, where I think my family probably hates me at this point because, yeah, voice control is like running everything with different scripts and triggers. And
yeah, that's stuff I love. Yeah, I think a couple of years ago I got you kind of started on home theater audio. And
oh boy, I've gone off the deep end, buddy. We'll have to catch up on that.
I told you that you can do wireless HDMI, and you're like, what? And you're
like, what? I don't mean to push you out, my tech buddy, but I want to ask Kate, just because I've spoken with so many women in tech, and I'm wondering what your experience has been like, you know, as a woman in tech, and not just tech, but also, you know, the medical and technical field, both in your education and your professional career. What challenges have come up, and just kind of holistically, how has that experience been for you?
Oh, I appreciate that question. I really do. But I do want to mention from the last, if I didn't talk about R and Python, I would never forgive myself, because the advancement of the models in the community that builds these open source models that can be applied is our lifeline. R and Python are the engines that we use to create all of our AI, and then we use technology to closely bind that to our Azure SQL cloud. And so anyway, so I wanted to say that we don't use any out of the box, these fine patterns in your data. We build them all in R and Python, but every day folks are coming out with new tools, the scientific community, to better interpret AI, better models of AI, better prediction within AI. And you wanted to say
something? Yeah, I was going to say just the business intelligence tools. That was one of the things, like last year, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, it's time just flying, but I looked at literally every BI tool on the market that would meet the needs. We have pretty strict needs on what we want to do. Kate mentioned R and Python, being able to develop in that and give that functionality and power to our end clients to build their own models. So that was a big deal. But I probably looked at, I'd say 30 or 40 different BI tools, had demos, and just,
wow,
until it scrambled my brain. So it came down to like three, and then we finally wound up on the one we wanted to partner with, and it's worked out great. So we're happy.
Yeah. We use Sisense because they allow us to do SQL with filters and then inject that into R and Python with just the data sets that we want. And so I think Looker was
bought by Google.
Right, which was bought by Google, which is an alternative to Sisense. But there's very few in the market that do exactly what we needed, which is we have our R and Python models. How do we connect those with SQL?
It's so funny how you said, you know, you spent so much time researching just all of these different tools and models that were available. And you kind of have like these two different problems that could come up. Like one is nobody's made anything that's going to work for you. And then the second is trying to dumpster dive through the minutia of all the different features of what's available. I mean, I wish I could have back just the hours that I have put analyzing different data and business tools out there, because when you look at them side by side at the high level features, you're like, oh, this all looks pretty comparable. I can take off maybe an eighth of them and look at these. Yeah. And then you start going another level deeper. You're like, okay, I'll take this one out over here.
Exactly.
It's really like the specific needs that you have that then end up delivering on what's going to be a viable product for you to be able to use. And it really is a insane amount of time. There's just like no spec sheet that you can look at a glance. It's like you have to get your hands on and start trying this stuff.
Exactly. And the websites say a whole lot about what the product can do, but then you get the people on the phone, you start asking them hard questions, and like, uh-oh, this ain't going to work. You know, within the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, why don't you get on a trial and then get back to me after 3 months of use? And
I trialed everything. I pulled Kate into different demos. And I mean, we asked him a lot of hard questions and there was only a few that could answer those. So.
And then you only ask the questions that you happen to know at the time. And until you start using the product, sometimes you don't even know what to ask until you reach a dead end. And then you're like, hey, by the way, can it? And they're like, yeah, it's on a roadmap. You're like, and on to the next.
I hate hearing that word roadmap.
Yeah. It's in our backlog. Oh, we're coming out with that in 2 months. Oh, by 2 months, you mean 2 years. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a startup. We're moving fast. We don't have 2 months. We don't have a week.
We're going to put links in the show notes to all of the fun, geeky stuff that people can like dig deeper into and do some more reading on. But yeah, back to Kate and your experience about...
You know, it's been mixed. Definitely been in my share of meetings where they're like, where is he? He who made this? No, that's me. No, him. No, me. No, him. No, me.
Yeah, literally, we talked to a group that came in. They came in. It was Kate and I sitting at a table. They came in and they all looked at me. They're like, we looked at your data model. It's awesome. I'm like, well, I'm just a creative guy.
You're like, yeah, I did the UI.
They're like, no, but you built this. It's really cool. No, I didn't do it. That's all her. So.
Yeah, I mean, and we're kind of reversed in that, you know, of the stereotype in that I am the technical one, you know, and he's the creative one. And I think everybody expects it to be reversed, which is, it's okay. It's fine. It's tough sometimes because you waste so much time just getting over the hump of, okay, let's talk about what we need to do here and the technology and the models and let's move forward. But we got to waste 30 minutes because I have to prove to you that it's not a him, it's a me, you know? So, I mean, that I run into a lot. But on the flip side, then you do get more attention on occasion for being a female in this space. So it has both its pros and cons, I guess. Mm-hmm. I hate wasting time, though. I really just was like, I really just want to get on with it. You know, it's like, let's move on and get past your stereotypes already. So.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you were on a path that ended up working out. In other words, you have a long history of academia and a long history of research and lab work that eventually brought you to this path that's more entrepreneurial and building a product that is really going to have a positive influence on millions and millions of people in regards to their healthcare, which is phenomenal. So maybe you don't have a great answer to this next question, but it's a bit selfish on my part because I have a 17-year-old daughter who is now looking at colleges. She is also just a STEM beast, like mathematics maven. And if you could go back and talk to your 17 or 18-year-old self, what would you tell her, Kate?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, you see women do one of three things. And I'm not sure what the right answer is. They'll either become really, really hardened and there will be walls up like a fortress around them, or they will be, you know, more stereotypical to what people expect of them. And then secretly behind the scenes, maybe not take credit for anything, but secretly behind the scenes be doing all this stuff. Or they try to just be themselves. And that's not easy either. So I try to be myself, but I think that I struggle in that I think a lot of folks try to feel like they can influence me because I don't have the fortress and I'm not adhering to the stereotype. And so then maybe I get a little bit, what is it, the bump, the cars bumping in the racetrack a lot, you know, a lot of jockeying for position. So you either step down, you let the others have the position while you secretly do things in the background, or you hold your position as hard as you can, you know, or you get bumped around in the middle somewhere. And that's kind of what I chose, was the middle, where I'm constantly probably getting bruised, you know, bumped this way or that way, because I'm not going with the stereotype and I'm not hardened. I don't know what I would tell your daughter, but she's going to take one of three pathways. I don't think the middle pathway is the easiest, but it's the one I can live with and the one I can sleep with and the one that I feel like I'm most genuine with.
I think that's a fair answer. Genuine, that makes sense to me. I think that rings true. And Ken, I know it got super analytical. We might have to have a follow-up that just goes in interaction design and user interface design. The meat and potatoes of the back end that I thought was the most interesting part of this, of course, since we can doodle and sketch in Photoshop all day long. That's how my brain tends to work for the most part as well. But yeah, guys, this is so exciting. I hope that we get to have a follow-on conversation somewhere between like your Series C and, you know, Amazon or Apple scooping you guys up at some point along the way in there, right?
Yeah, please say exit. I can't
do this. raising money is really hard.
Oh my gosh, since I'm exhausted already.
We could have a whole conversation about that as well. Raising money is hard, and it's not just incredibly difficult as an endeavor in itself, but it's incredibly difficult to stay focused whatsoever on the actual product that you're trying to get out, because the fundraising part is just so distracting and the hoops you had to jump through. And I got to chat with you a little bit a couple of weeks ago, Ken, and it really sounded like you guys made some very specific decisions as to who you brought in regards to their interest in the space and who could add value. And I know that's an extra layer of work on top of an already arduous task. So, you know, congrats to you guys on that.
Yeah, I can't end this interview without mentioning Roger Akers. Roger's He's a good friend of mine. I've known him for a number of years here in Sacramento. He's well known. He's helped a lot of businesses. The guy's just been amazing. He's done a lot of heavy lifting for us, opened a lot of doors. And yeah, this whole thing was, you know, really when we teamed up with Roger over a year ago, that's when things really started happening.
That's awesome. And is he an angel investor or a venture guy?
Yeah, he's an angel investor.
Yeah, he's an angel investor. And really, we consider him one of our co-founders because he was that instrumental in taking us, you know, when we saw him, what we had was a manifesto and a prototype, you know, this is what we want to build, 150-page design document, you know, right. Just figure out how to get that built for real. And
he's introduced us to so many
more. And he was our lead in fundraising.
Yeah, there's so many great people from, you know, not just Sacramento area, but everywhere that has joined our team. As an investor, I think we have 30 or 31 angel investors, and they're all amazing. They all provide advice in different realms and different things we're going through. So these are very successful people that have been here and done that. We feel very fortunate to have a good mixed bag of angels behind us.
I'm so happy it went that way for you. I know it can go either way. You know, you can have 30 retired dentists write you a check and you know, and then ask you for monthly financial reports, or, you know, you can get people who are actually really contributing in the world of introductions and other relationships and information and on, because I mean, that's what this is all about, right? Is just being connected to the people who can help the most through their relationships. This is just it's a people game.
Yeah. We looked at the VC route. We had a couple of term sheets from VCs, and you know what? We wound up, actually, I think we turned those down, and we wound up getting a better situation and having, you know, a large group of angels, you know, with all this mixed diversity of skill sets. So I think we really lucked out. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have all those folks on our team and be able to reach out to them and get invaluable advice.
Yeah, I think Sacramento is a good bed for us as well, being in Sacramento, California. I mean, we went over to pitch in the Bay Area. As I mentioned, didn't have too much success before COVID, although it helped us hone our pitch. But here in Sacramento, they really value the startups and invest in them. And not that they don't in the Bay Area, but maybe there's more competition and it's not seen as a hometown pride thing. There's this really nice hometown pride aspect of being in this little hotbed versus a big hotbed.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll tell you what, the game is changing really, really quickly with the geography of tech and what is considered a hotbed or a good place to start a company. And you can thank COVID for that to a great extent as well, right? I mean, it's funny now, you know, you talk to somebody living in the middle of America and they're starting something and they're speaking to investors. The investors say, well, what's your next move? And where do you see your headquarters being like, oh, I'm going to go to San Francisco. I want to be in Silicon Valley. And like these seasoned investors look at them and kind of shrug and ask, why? Like, why do you feel like you have to do that? Speaking of things that are becoming decentralized, talent is becoming decentralized. People are realizing that they don't have to live in like one of four cities in order to be in tech or to raise money or to find a good team. I left the Bay Area and then went down to Southern California, was in West LA, saw the whole explosion of Silicon Beach and all the e-commerce moved down there. A lot of venture money moved down there and people saying like, oh, I can have my summers and financing and a good team all at once. I don't need to be in the Bay Area. And then you started seeing people leaving Southern California or California altogether. You know, I moved to Salt Lake City and there's an incredible venture and tech scene in Salt Lake City, Lehigh and Park City now that's just getting bigger and bigger. And you know, then of course, same thing happened in Austin and it's just happening in all of these cities across the country. And I love it. I love the idea of just, you know, you have kids, family, think about just overall quality of life and the diversity of the different people that you're going to meet that aren't necessarily the San Jose programmers. It's nice. I love that Sacramento's on the up and coming list too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's great.
Well, now that COVID's over, I'll have to come visit you guys pretty soon. I'll be taking the show on the road, literally.
Awesome.
And starting to fly around with a little portable studio and talking to different people. So I'll look you guys up when I'm in my Northern California section of all of that. And I really appreciate it. I love what you guys are doing. I want to say you're the first med tech people that I've gotten to speak to so far, even though I am early on in this whole adventure, but so excited that I've gotten to see up close some of the progress and innovation that you guys have gone through. It's so cool.
Thank you. Yeah, can't wait to walk you through it.
I can't wait to see it all. Yeah. I can't wait to see the app too. I want something I can actually download and play with.
I know. I can't wait till you're on the app. You're going to be one of our alpha testers.
Yeah.
I'll give you all sorts of unsolicited feedback. Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much. So good to chat.
Thanks so much.
Eric and I run Spark 6, an agency committed to designing and building software and other digital products that do good in the world.
For show notes and links, go to goodUXpodcast.com.
Please subscribe at Apple Podcasts, and if you're an Android user, check us out on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this podcast, please recommend us to a friend.
And we'll be back next time for more on how tech just might make us better entrepreneurs, students, artists, parents, and overall happier people.
Mostly happy.
Yeah.